This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, the Dean of all things STEM and STEAM. And this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
I'm going to correct you today, Miss Jennifer. Hello, Jennifer and listeners, but it is Galactic Space Geek who loves moons in our solar system, Jeff, because we have an excellent guest to talk about some wonderful missions today.
So what problem are we solving today?
How do you study another planet's moon?
Oh, I see. How do you study another planet's moon? I can guess you are not at all excited about this, Jeff. Who is our guest today?
Not at all excited to talk to super fantastic flight systems engineer for NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Miss Tracy Drain.
Welcome to the show, Tracy.
Thank you so much for having me. I can already tell we're going to have a great time today.
We are. We're going to have so much fun because we're talking about moons. And I know Jeff is like jumping up and down. You can't see it, people, but he's jumping up and down already.
I can see it.
Okay, so let's just dive right in. So I always like to start, did you always want to do this, to study moons on other planets since you were a kid? Were you always looking into the sky?
You know, I was always interested in a whole bunch of things, but space was a big one of them. I was indeed always looking into the sky, watching science fiction shows with my mom. And when I decided to go to school, I wanted to study something that would allow me to work for a company like NASA someday.
Or yes.
Well, nicely done. So in between the all of the things and space being one of them, was there somewhere along the way, middle school, high school, college, that sort of leaned you towards, okay, space is going to be the thing?
It was pretty much in high school. You know how all the adults ask you that seriously annoying question,
boy. What do you want to be?
Yes. Absolutely. Yes.
And listeners, younger, get ready. It's coming.
Like a pilot, a lawyer, an archaeologist. Like I was kind of all over the map. But then in high school, around junior year, it started to get a little more specific. So what are you going to study in school? Uh-oh.
And I
kind of wanted to study astronomy. But I'm old enough that there was no internet back then, and I didn't have a good idea of astronomers did, right? Like,
ditto!
Yes.
Totally my story.
Yes.
And
yes.
So I knew that engineers, like, built things, did things. It was easier for me to imagine someone would pay me for doing that. And if we ever came up
which
with,
is
like,
important. Yes.
It is. I kind of need to eat. And if we were ever going to have, like, the Starship Enterprise, I could be like Geordi's assistant, fixing stuff in the engine. So that's why I decided to study engineering.
I love it.
Yes, that's awesome. Because I think all of us on here can say we're Trekkies and we all grew up with that, you know, and all of these different things. So tell us about engineering. How did you like learning about engineering? Because, you know, even now, unfortunately, there's still not a lot of women in that career, but it's a really cool thing to study. So what did you think about mechanical engineering?
It is a cool thing to study. I picked mechanical because I really liked the idea of general problem solving to make machines that would do stuff, right? It's not really about, I mean, I've always been good friends with math. Me and math are tight. I've always really liked physics, but the theoretical side of things was interesting, but wasn't exciting to me the way that taking that knowledge and turning it into something you can touch with your hands and make things do stuff in the real world.
That's
and
awesome.
So for me, being in classes, you're right, there weren't that many women. I think there were like five girls in my mechanical engineering classes, and three of us became like the Three Musketeers running around doing all sorts of stuff.
That's awesome.
And it was really just about diving in there and having fun with the, it was almost like mystery puzzles that we got in classes. How does this work? How does that work? Design of this thing, design of that thing. And I just really enjoyed that a lot.
Oh, yeah.
I really think your answer is going to resonate with a whole lot of listeners. I have an 11-year-old daughter who has flopped back and forth between what do you want to be when you grow up, either a NASA astronaut or a NASA engineer. Mm. And I have been thrilled that she has added that to the list.
Yay.
But the way you were just describing, you know, part of the base reason for Solve It for Kids as a podcast is to give kids and families an idea of what's behind that job title.
Yeah.
You know, people see mechanical engineer or systems engineer, but they don't actually know what they're doing. And Miss Tracy, the way you were just describing, you know, we got a puzzle of we want a machine to do X, to do this thing. And I see my daughter playing outside with her friends. And if she had the tools that grownups get to have at the JPL, I could easily imagine them wanting to build something new every time they came up with a new idea. Like, how do you collect pine cones? How do you do this? How do you clean off?
Yes.
How do you clean off the driveway from the mess we just made?
That's great.
Yes.
So what was it in... I'm trying to figure out how you figured out that mechanical engineering was going to be that.
Oh, wow. That's a good question. How did I do that?
Because I've never heard it explained that way before in such a way that I think kids are going to be like, bam, that's the job I want.
You know, I don't think I had figured it out when I chose to study mechanical engineering. I think that when I was doing my little mental thought process, okay, can't be an astronomer, don't know how people are going to pay me. Engineering was just, you understood this vague blob that engineers did stuff. And when I thought about the different kinds of engineering disciplines, there is aerospace engineering. And you might think, well, why didn't you choose to go do that? And that was mainly because even though I didn't know a lot about the industry, I knew aerospace industry had its ups and downs, and you would be like employed and then laid off and employed and laid off. I'm like, I want to skip that. And then I knew that mechanical engineering was a very foundational kind of basic thing that you needed for all sorts of different machines. So I figured, well, if I can't get a job at NASA, I can probably build cars or airplanes or
refrigerators. Okay.
That seems flexible.
Yeah, so that's cool.
Once I started studying things in school and learning from the instructors what it was all about, that I started to more understand that kind of description that I'd given you before.
Yep. That's awesome. Okay, so now let's jump all of these years ahead and let's talk about the really exciting stuff, what you're doing right now.
Okay.
So how do you study another planet's moon?
Yeah. Oh, how do I make this not be a really long answer? So the way we do it here at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and me as a flight system engineer, we build robotic spacecraft. So there's no people in them.
Right.
That can go a long way away from the Earth out to these other really cool things that are out there and study them using cameras or different kinds of instruments to make different kinds of measurements and send all the information all the way back to Earth by radio. So that scientists can take the data and do analysis on it and use math and all sorts of logic in order to answer questions about the things that we are studying. And in order to get the instruments close to the thing, you have to build a spacecraft that is going to protect them, to keep them from getting too hot or too cold.
Yes.
Right.
To be able to send their data all the way back, to point them in the right place at the right time.
You
can think of the instruments, we call it a payload. They're like the important pieces there to get all the science data. But they can't just go by themselves. They're little baby instruments. So you have to put them in the spacecraft to protect them and get them there.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah, it's such a cool process. Man, I'm so jealous of your job. And so our question is very basic of how do you study another planet's moon? Jen and I can see it right now as your background on this Zoom call, but can you tell us what moon is super important for NASA to get out and study next?
I can. So Jupiter, my favorite planet in the whole solar system,
is
our largest planet. It's like 10 times the diameter of the Earth. You can fit 10, 11, 11. I think it's 11. Earth is across the middle of Jupiter. And it has a lot of moons. Your kids who are listening who have not thought about Jupiter and moons before will be shocked to know it has well over 70 moons. There's a whole bunch of moons. I can't even remember the number because more discovered over the years.
Yes.
And the four biggest ones that Galileo saw in his telescope way back in the early 1600s called Ganymede. That's the biggest one. Callisto. And then Io and Europa. And Europa is my favorite moon in the whole solar system because scientists think that underneath a shell of ice, and we're not sure how thick it is, could be a 15 to 25 kilometers. I'm making that up. Go Google search. But we're not sure how thick it is. Underneath that ice shell, there is probably more water than all of the Earth's oceans combined times And even though I had mentioned before that it's kind of sitting in this donut of radiation around Jupiter, that the ice can be a protecting for whatever might be down there. So scientists are wondering whether it has all of the right ingredients that could support life, water and maybe like carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, hydrogen, phosphorus, and all the way down to the bottom of that deep ocean, there's probably rock. And so you might think to yourself, okay, water, geez, well, if it's ice on top and it's really, really far away from the sun, Jupiter's like five times farther away from the sun.
Right, right.
Yes. Like, I know where you're going.
With the water? Like, dude, why? And so the theory is like this. The moon, Europa, orbits Jupiter, but its orbit is not perfectly circular. And the way gravity works, if you're near something that's really big, like Jupiter, and it's pulling on you with its gravity, the closer you are, the stronger gravity is.
Yes.
The farther you are, the less gravity pulls, the weaker it is.
Right.
And so because Europa's orbiting and it's not a perfect circle, sometimes it's closer, sometimes it's farther. So sometimes it's getting pulled harder, sometimes it's getting pulled less hard. And that tends to like squeeze and relax and squeeze and relax and squeeze and relax. And if you've ever taken a paperclip and like bent it back and forth and back and forth and back and forth until it breaks and then touched the end, it's pretty warm, like because all those molecules that's what's happening inside Europa. And it makes enough heat to keep a whole bunch of water melted under that cap of ice.
Wow. That's amazing. So how long have we been studying Europa? Mm. And, you know, how did we find all this? Was it luck? Like, oh, hey, we're going to study that. And we're like, oh, look, we found water. You know, or did we have an idea that that's what we were going to see when we were looking there?
Right. So there is some luck involved in science, but it's, what is it? It's like opportunity plus preparation equals.
Yes.
But so scientists and engineers got together way a long time ago from JPL, built a spacecraft called Galileo, sent it out to primarily study Jupiter, but it also did flybys of some of the moons like Ganymede, Io, and Europa. And it had this really special instrument on board called a magnetometer, which measures the strength and the direction of the magnetic field around a planet. And we should talk a bit about why Jupiter has this really cool magnetic field. But so Galileo, the spacecraft, has this magnetometer, and it was able to detect that Jupiter's magnetic field lines are bent around Europa. And the scientists were like, whoa, what's up with that?
Yeah.
And it turns out that water is a conductor, salty water, briny water, like on the Earth. When you have the tides where the Earth's water oceans move and you get the tides that come in and out, that actually bends the Earth's magnetic field. And scientists deduced that something, probably some kind of briny water under the ice, must be bending the magnetic field lines around Jupiter. They're like, well, it's got to be a bunch of water under there.
And that is a lot of logics. I mean, you boiled it down to very small things, but wow, that's a lot of logic.
But also, see this picture of the moon Europa behind me. We'll have to put a snapshot in the link so the kids can see it. When you look at our moon, it has craters all over the place. Like, and so scientists understand it's a very old surface that's been hit with like space rocks that cause all these craters. There's no wind, there's no rain, so they just stay there forever. If you look at this, you're like, so there's a bunch of cracks, but where's all the craters?
Yes.
And if you look at another picture, you can see like there's one near the southern hemisphere, which is huge, like this big crater that radiates things out all over the place, like these big sprays. There aren't that many craters on Europa, and there's all these cracks. And so scientists think that it must have gotten hit with a lot of face rocks, just like a whole bunch of other things in our solar system.
Sure.
But if there's a bunch of water and it's getting squished and released and squished and released all the time, then that ice can crack, water can flow out, fill in the craters.
Ah.
The idea is there's this kind of process that's refreshing the surface and making it look geologically young like that. So that, plus the bent magnetic field lines, like some pretty big clues that there's a bunch of water.
It really is cool, especially when you think about how far away Jupiter and Europa are, and we are just learning this stuff as little baby humans here on our planet, third rock from the sun. We are studying Europa right now. Can you tell us about this next exciting mission that's coming up to Europa?
Boy, can I? Yes. I have been working on this mission for the last 2 years of my life. There are many people who've been working on it a lot longer than that. But I am currently the lead flight system engineer for the Europa Clipper mission. And we are in the process of like actually getting a whole bunch of hardware that's coming in, and we're integrating it and testing it on our way towards launching in October of 2024. And what we're doing, I know, it's so funny because when I say that to some people, they're like, that's 2 years away. That's a long time. And I'm like, that's
not an engineering year. That's not an engineering year.
It'll be so fast. It's kind of outrageous. But it's a mission that has a whole bunch of really cool instruments. It's got visible cameras on it to take really cool pictures of the surface and help scientists understand what's going on with the surface that way. It's got a magnetometer, sort of a newer version of the one that Galileo had, which will help us learn more about the way that the moon is structured on the inside. It has got radars, ice-penetrating radars are going to help us understand how thick the ice is.
It's got
thermal imagers so you can look for hot spots on the surface. It's got instruments that are going to measure particles that we see around it if we are lucky enough to fly through an ice plume, like a water plume. Holy cow. It's just festooned with all these delicious science instruments that are going to teach us so many things. And when we launch it, it's going to take us about 5.5 years to get there. So kids, when you're listening, 2 years from now, plus 5.5 years, it'll be 5.5 years. You'll all be like in high school. Holy cow. We're going to go out and do a flyby of Mars and a flyby of Earth in order get an
boost. I was just about to ask.
That's what's happening. And then when we get there, we are going to put the spacecraft in orbit around Jupiter in a really big orbit that'll take 14 days to go around every time. And then we're going to dip into the radiation field to do a flyby of Europa once on every one of those in order to get close in and take data with all our really juicy instruments. And the thing that's hilarious, not hilarious, almost scary, is how close we're going to get to the surface. This number might not mean anything to kids, but we are going to be flying over the surface and our lowest altitudes, not all of them are that low, but our lowest altitude, 25 kilometers.
Wow. That is pretty close.
That's less than half the lunar lander when it was orbiting.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, right? It is really close. So when you think about the fact that Jupiter is going to be like well over 500 million miles away, and we're going to put a spacecraft in orbit around it and then like go buzz in the tower on Europa like once every 14 days for about 50 times in order to get a bunch of data. That's how we're going to learn more today than we do so far about that. Really cool.
I mean, that's really amazing that humans can do something like this. I am forever just boggled by this. Like, we can create a spacecraft that can manage all of these different things, right? Like, it has to be the right temperature. It has to be able to communicate. It has to go through this crazy radiation belt, which I want to hear about. What is this radiation belt that we can understand, you know, how like difficult this is and why you wouldn't be orbiting just around Europa?
Oh, here we go. This is going to be a long answer. Sorry. why does Jupiter have this radiation belt in the first place? So Jupiter, really big, 11 Earths across the middle, and it is mostly made of hydrogen and helium.
Okay.
You know, the helium gas that you can sip at.
That you can make the balloons with. Yes.
So like almost 90% hydrogen, almost 10% helium, and traces of other things, which give it those really pretty colors. And because it's so massive, it has so much gravity, it squeezes in on itself so hard that when you get deep under the cloud tops, you get to a point where the hydrogen is compressed into a liquid. And when you keep going, it's so compressed and so hot that the little electrons that's going around the nucleus of the hydrogen atom gets stripped off and it's free to flow around inside there.
Right.
And when you have flowing electrons, that creates electricity.
Yep.
Even though the moon, Jupiter, is so big, it rotates really fast. Like our Earth rotates on its axis one time in every 24 hours. That's our day.
Yes.
Jupiter rotates once every 10 hours. So you've got this massive thing rotating really
fast. This big, huge thing spins that fast? That seems counterintuitive, right? Like you wouldn't think something that big and heavy would spin that fast.
It's bananas, right? And so you have this flowing electrons, which is rotating. And when you rotate an electrical field, that generates a magnetic field. New fun fact for kids who do not know that. And this magnetic field, because Jupiter is big, it's spinning so fast, it's enormous, like just huge. And it's very strong and it captures charged particles, which is like, you know, like the solar wind has these charged particles in
right.
it. And Io, one of the moons, and I eat great candy. Io is very volcanic and it is spewing tons of sulfur dioxide out all the time. I think I read online today, so go check this fact. I did not double check my source. like a ton of sulfur dioxide every second, like some just
Whoa.
Ridiculous.
Wow.
And the sulfur dioxide gas gets out into space and then it breaks down in space. And so you get ions of hydrogen and sulfur and oxygen. And then there's the little electrons that are out there anyway. And all of those things get trapped in the magnetic field lines and then accelerated to near the speed of light. They're going really, really
Whoa.
Fast. And that's what makes this radiation zone, this radiation belt that's there in this donut around Jupiter. And Io and Europa are in there. Io is in the worst one. Europa is toward the edge, but it's still enough that if we tried to like stick our little baby spacecraft in there all the time, like it would just fry the electronics and develop something that would like. And the number that sticks in my mind is from the Juno spacecraft, which I worked on for 9 whole years of my
right.
life, as old as some of your listeners have been alive. And that spacecraft is still in orbit. And it also has a very big orbit around Jupiter. And it's mostly studying Jupiter, but it only spends like 6 hours flying by Jupiter and then gets the heck out of there for like 53 and a half days. And I know, right? So the statistic that I remember about that is, and it's 32 orbits. It was originally only going to do 32 orbits. It was going to develop a radiation dose that was the equivalent of like 100 million dental x-rays, like something outrageous.
Oh my goodness.
Which is the equivalent of like sitting in the dentist chair, getting an x-ray once a second, every second for like 3 years. It's
kind of crazy. No, thank you. I know.
You're going to go with bad.
You would kind of die. Our Europa spacecraft is going to see way more of a radiation dose than the Juno spacecraft will in its lifetime. And the way we handle that is by building literally a vault around.
I was going to ask that. You have to have special materials to shield it or something, right?
That's
just like
right.
when we're in the dentist chair and they put the thing over
the
top of
you.
The metal thing.
Exactly. Now we can't use lead out in space because that's really heavy. And the heavier your spacecraft is, the harder it is to get off the Earth and get all the way to where you're going. So Juno used titanium. Clipper is using, I should know this, pretty sure it's aluminum. But if you make it thick enough, then it can cut down on the amount of radiation that's getting to your electronics and save the day. Your spacecraft will be able to survive through the whole mission. But it's easier to do that if you're only spending a limited amount of time in the radiation zone,
right?
Looking at it all the time.
Wow.
Wow. There's so many wow moments here. And oh my gosh, we could get stuck on any one. But based on the science instruments that the Europa Clipper is carrying, are we going to get more information about whether or not Europa is a very good place to find life? More so than we have now.
Great question. So one of the main purposes, if not the main purpose, if my lead scientist, Bob Papalotto, were here, he would smack me and say, you should know verbatim the answer to this question. The main purpose of Europa is to investigate the habitability of Europa. So what kind of surface is there?
Yeah.
You know, can we tell about how thick this ice layer is? And can we tell things about the water? We know that it's been there for a really long time, stable. And those are kind of the things that go together to make a place habitable. You have a source of energy. It's got the sun. It's way far away, but it's also got the source of heat from inside.
Because of all that
reflecting we were talking about. And we have instruments that will tell us that are looking down at the surface, like what the chemical composition of the surface is. And if we're very fortunate to be there when there's a plume, like maybe there are geysers of water that are coming out there.
Yes.
Like what the components of those are. So all of the different measurements that the science instruments are trying to make are geared towards helping us understand whether Europa really is a place that is suitable for the development of life.
Wow. And there really are so many different factors that go into that.
Yeah.
There really are. Yeah.
Okay. So I want to know, you're spending years of your life creating this. You're sending it off. You're going to, you know, I assume blast it off on a rocket and off it's going to go. It's going to take 5.5 years to get there. What happens if something doesn't work?
Oh.
Like, it's not like we can put astronauts and be like, oh, hey, we'll send out, you know, you'll fly out there with your little toolkit and fix it, right? You know,
right.
So like, can it fix itself, I guess, is the question. And all
and
those kinds of things.
That's one of the kinds of things that systems engineers like me think about all the time. And I literally have a group of people on my team. I have like a whole bunch of people on my team, but there's a subunit of my team who are the fault protection team. And their job is to think
about
like all
that.
The
fault
things
protection.
That are going on.
There
fault
you
protection.
Go.
We need like big blue shields. And their whole job is to think of all the different things that can go wrong with a spacecraft. And we try to either make sure by doing something with the design that it literally cannot happen, or if it can happen, that the spacecraft can do something so that it won't like completely kill the whole mission. And I'll give you an example. We have two or more of most engineering components that are necessary to make the mission be successful. So one of the ways that the spacecraft knows where it is, there's a thing called a star tracker, and you use it to, like, it's got a whole catalog of stars inside it. And when it's looking at something, it can figure out what direction it's pointed in.
Okay.
Right. Okay.
We have one of those, because if it goes belly up, we're toast. So we have two. It's not like an inertial measurement unit. So there are some times when you're not using the star trackers where, like, so, you know, in your body, if you're standing still and someone tells you turn 90 degrees to the right and you turn, you kind of have a memory of where you were. And if you have your eyes open and then you shut your eyes and you turn 90 degrees, you kind of have a mental model of where you are. And IMU is sort of like that. It can kind of integrate up based on where it's been and what it's doing. And it can do that for some time before it starts to go a little off. Like if somebody told you to look at the room, close your eyes, and then turn all the way around, and then turn all the way around, and then turn all the way around, and keep doing that, you would kind of lose track of where you were.
Yes.
Yes.
So IMUs can be like that over time too. But we need them. And we don't just have one, we have two. And there are a bunch of things like that. And so one of the things that our fault protection team is responsible for is figuring out what kind of clues in the spacecraft behavior or in the data and the software, if the spacecraft starts doing X, well, that means there's a problem with the star tracker. Switch to the backup unit. Right.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And obviously it would, but that does make a lot of sense when you explain it that way.
Yeah.
So all of this data that the spacecraft is going to be collecting, us humans would like it back here on Earth.
How about that?
So, yeah, how about that? It can't just keep it out there and be like, I know something you don't know. No, it's got to send it back to us here on Earth. And I think all of us get that spacecraft send data back to Earth through those communication waves. How quickly, I know different spacecraft have different data rates and different processors and computers and things like that. How quickly will we get data back from the Europa Clipper? So space geeks like me can be searching online and searching NASA's website to find out what it found out.
There are so many layers to that question. Let's see. So I'll tell you about it. There's three different distinct pieces of that. There is A, how fast do radio signals travel? Speed of light, that part's easy. But Jupiter is so far away, and I haven't looked this up for Europa Clipper, but I still have some numbers buried in my brain from Juno, that there were times, especially like when Juno first got to Jupiter at orbit insertion, and you have to think about where the Earth is relative to the Sun and where Jupiter is relative to the Sun. But the time lag, the time it would take for the Earth to send a signal out to Jupiter to say, you know, hey, baby spacecraft, how's it going? Was about 50 minutes. So you'd send a command, go have lunch. And the spacecraft hears that, you know, hey, what's going on? And it'll say, I'm doing just fine. And then it takes 50 minutes for the signal to get all the way back. You'd send your lunch. And then you'd come back and you'd hear, I'm doing just fine. And so that is like just pure time lag, right? But then there is the rates that you mentioned, because even though the signal travels at the speed of light, you can't send like every single bit of data all at the same time at the speed of light.
Right.
It has to come down in a specific data rate. And so it might take, you know, hours, days for the information to drain out of the computer for you to get all your data back on Earth. So that's another one. I don't have these specifics, but it's kind of like on that word.
Okay.
But then when the data comes back, it's what we call raw data. It's like, you know,
yes,
information right. that will mean something to scientists once they turn the crank on their analysis tools, but it won't mean anything right. to you and me on the ground. If we got the raw data, we'd be like, wow, I have no idea what you're talking about. So the scientists then have to take that, do some analysis, think about it, do the mystery logic puzzle, like, what can this mean? Then they're ready to say, look what we learned about Europa. And depending on what kind of information they're looking for, or how complicated that is, like, that could take some time.
Which yeah,
is why right.
you get a spacecraft, you put it in orbit, and you're like, oh, it's in orbit, and well, how come we haven't heard anything from anybody? That might be a little while. I'm not going to make up any numbers and make the scientists all mad at me, but that's what causes some delay, too. So you'll
okay.
have to wait.
Okay.
It'll be worth waiting for.
Oh, yeah. Well, that we have no doubt. So, okay, I'm curious, how big is this? And how is it being powered once it's there? Because, I mean, are we sending it with, like, batteries that are going to last for a really long time? Or
that's a good question. So the spacecraft is really, really big. It has, maybe we can put a link to a picture of it somewhere.
Yes, absolutely.
But the two solar arrays that stretch way out to the sides are 30 meters in length.
Ooh.
30 meters
Whoa.
In length. So if you
okay.
put the spacecraft on an NBA-sized basketball court, the edges of the solar arrays will, like, hang off the sides. It's really
wow.
big.
Wow.
And that's
okay.
because when you go all the way out at Jupiter, there's much less sunlight that there is here
right.
on the Earth. So imagine this. I wish we had a video we could stick in here. But so think about a balloon, and you're blowing up the surface of the balloon. If you draw
yes.
a square on the balloon, and then you blow it up to twice the radius, that square will end up getting stretched to twice the length and twice the width. And
right.
for kids who are a little bit older, they will know that the area is the length times the width. And so instead of just like an area of 1 inch, if you blow it up and now it's 2 inches by 2 inches, 2 times 2 is 4, the area is 4 inches. So
right.
when you're twice the radius, that means your surface area gets stretched out to 4 times the surface area. And the little amount of plastic that was inside the square you drew now is stretched over. It has to be stretched over 4 times the area. So it's much thinner.
Wow.
And the surface, the like sunlight going out from the sun is just like that. And so here we are at like a 1 unit. We'll call it 1 astronomical unit from the sun. And if you go all the way out to 2 times farther away, that means you only get 1/4, 1/4 the amount of light.
Right.
Jupiter is more than 5 times farther away from the sun than the Earth is. So it
wow.
only gets 1/5 times 5, 25, 1/25, 1/25th the amount of light out there. So that's why we have to have giant solar arrays to make what will sound like a pretty piddly amount of power. Our huge solar arrays are intended to be able to give us like over 700 watts of power, which is like half of what your microwave makes, like most microwaves.
Oh, my gosh.
And that has to be enough power to run all the heaters and keep things from getting too cold, to run our star tracker and our IMU, our inertial measuring unit, all the other engineering components,
wow.
and all the instruments, and the telecom system to send all the data back, like all of that. And so things have to be designed to be very power efficient. Now, we also have batteries.
Oh,
and that's
okay.
because
okay.
sometimes, like even though out in space, the sun's shining all day, sometimes
right.
you end up going into the shadow. Like we'll pass behind Jupiter. Jupiter's big. It'll block the sun. And then
right.
we have to rely on our batteries. Or if we have to do like fire our engines, you got to fire it in the right direction at the right time. That means you got to turn your whole spacecraft. Maybe your solar rays aren't pointed at the sun for a while. So you have to rely on your batteries while that's happening.
Okay.
Cool.
So I know we can't talk to you forever, and you have already given all of us a ton to look up and take this further for Europa. I do want to ask one further question for you, Tracy. You are a lead on the program for this Europa mission. Will you stay with the Europa mission all the way through its life cycle, or will you at some point step off of this program and move to a different program?
That is a great question. You would think I would have a crisp answer for you. Nope. I'm going to tell
Crystal
you.
Crystal ball. Here we go.
I'm going to tell you about my Juno experience by
okay.
way of telling you why I do not have a crisp answer for Europa. So I joined the Juno mission 2 years before launch in 2009. We launched that spacecraft in 2011. I was one of the flight system engineers on the team, actually flight and project system. And my intention was to stay into operations. Yay. And so I did, but I was only planning to stay into ops for the first couple of years. It took Juno 5 years to get all the way out to Jupiter.
Yes.
And then I was going to go off and do something else. But we kept having so many super fun, let's call them mystery puzzles to solve. That there was this never a dull moment. I was having a good time. So I just stuck around. And then once we arrived, we had even more mystery puzzles to solve. And so I wound up being like 2 years before launch, the whole 5 years to get there. And then another 2 years after we arrived for 9 whole years.
Wow.
And it wasn't my plan going yet. And on Europa Clipper, the current plan is that I will stay through launch and probably at least a couple of months after launch, make sure the spacecraft is okay before doing something else. But you never know.
Yeah.
This is really interesting. And depending on who stays and goes and does things, if they need a super savvy Swiss Army knife systems engineer to stick around, I might come back. We'll see what happens.
I mean, I love that because it's like following your curiosity, right? Whatever you think is amazing and you're curious about, that's what you get to do. That's what I hear that this is a cool job for. You know, that's what I would love to do.
100%.
Well, like Jeff said, we could talk to you forever, but we are at that time in the show where we ask you for the challenge. So I'm very curious to hear what your challenge is for our listeners, because we talked about so many different things.
We did talk about so many different things, but I would like to challenge a listener to go find out about magnetism and magnetic fields and what they are and how they work, since that was one of the big clues for scientists to know that there was water on Europa. That's one of the ways that we will continue studying Europa and what it's all like there. So yeah, go have fun with that.
Yeah. Well, and Tracy gave us this really excellent link for NASA where they have lots of challenges for you with magnetism. So we will put that on the website so you can find that. But this has been a fabulous show, Tracy. We will definitely have to have you back.
Yay. Absolutely. I was just going to say, everybody download this episode. Tell us you want to hear more from Tracy because we have to do this again.
Yeah. And we won't wait 7.5 years to it comes out. But thank you so much for being on Solving
for
Kids,
Tracy.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
What an absolutely energetic, enthusiastic, and awesome episode that was. How can you not be excited about going to explore Europa with Tracy Drain?
I don't think that's possible, Jeff.
Absolutely not.
I mean, she made it sound like so much fun. And that is one of the things I love about our show, Jeff. We get to talk to all of these awesome engineers and scientists and experts, and you can just hear how much they love their job. And Tracy was at the top for sure.
You said it.
But also, she made it understandable, right?
Very much so.
And exciting and fun. Now, I cannot wait for this mission to happen. It's going to be amazing to watch.
As Galactic Space Geek, Jeff, I have known about this mission for years now. Jupiter is also my favorite planet, like Tracy. So I am super excited about this, and I've taught lots of kids about this liquid ocean under the icy crust of Jupiter's moon Europa. So it begs the question, as soon as you hear liquid ocean, you go, I wonder what might be living in there. And even though this mission is going to take 5.5 years to get out there, you hit the nail on the head. Miss Tracy brought it right down into our level of understanding of what it takes to engineer a mission like this, and then what we're hoping to learn.
Yes, it was awesome. And her challenge, I thought, was really cool.
Yes.
So it's very simple, just learning about magnets and magnetic fields, because it's amazing how much that affected the spacecraft that they created and the trajectory and where it's going to orbit. So if you guys go out and look that up and find out about magnets, be sure that you share that with us, because I'm curious to see what you learn about magnets. Remember, we are at KidSolve on our social media, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And don't forget to check out our website, solveforkids.com, where we will have a whole page dedicated to this episode, and you can see what Tracy looks like when she's doing her job, because I'm sure she has one of those like moments, right? And they're unforgettable, and she just makes science exciting.
I feel like Tracy and anybody that gets to work with her gets those moments nearly every day. How fun is that? But that's also kind of how I feel about working with you, Jen, and this podcast, because we get to share in that excitement of all of those scientists, engineers, and experts across so many different fields. You know, space is just that one that hits it for me. So definitely, everybody, go out, play with those magnets. Don't be afraid to do it on a piece of paper and draw your own magnetic fields, a neat addition to what Tracy gave us. And until next time, you'll hear Jen and Jeff on
Solve It for Kids.